There's another engineering principle that is called product ownership or end-to-end product ownership. That's like more than being an engineer, you are a problem solver.
Hi, I'm David. This is Build to Succeed from Very Good Ventures. Today we speak with Tiago Ghisi, Director of Engineering at Nubank. They run an app that serves over 100 million customers on multiple platforms in many countries, with 1,000 screens and delivering updates every day. We're going to dig into how Nubank manages this complexity with Flutter and server-driven UI and stays at the cutting edge of mobile. So let's get into it with Tiago. Okay, Tiago, welcome to Build to Succeed. Thrilled to have you here. You've had just such an awesome career. I know you were at ThoughtWorks, Amex, Apple, now Nubank, all incredible companies, just amazing resume you've got. And so I wanted to just get us started by maybe you could take a look back and kind of tell us a little bit about your career, all the places you've been, and maybe some themes of your career that you've identified over time.
Amazing. So thank you so much for the invite, David. It's a pleasure to be here. I think like you're doing an incredible job like by interviewing folks on the mobile/Flutter community. And it's a pleasure to be here talking about what we are doing and my career in general. So I think like my career, so I started almost 20 years ago. I would say I was the typical started with like Java, then kind of like did web, then like did QA, did other things. And then eventually, maybe back, I don't know, it was 2009, 2010, started work even before Android with Java ME, right? Did some projects back in the day with that and then transitioned into Android. And after that, I did a lot of like full stack engineering, migrations to the cloud. I'm a very generalist person by heart. And over the last, I would say 7-8 years, I have been on the engineering management path. So more on the managerial side of things, but still pretty much working with mobile all this time. So like, even though I'm not, and I'm generally against like people that only work in one platform, I have been working a lot with mobile and a lot of fintech over the past like 8 to 10 years. And like to talk a little bit about my career, I think like two general themes that I have identified to myself, and I have written a lot about this. I think one is about kind of like being the glue person. And like the other one is about being a full stack engineer, or I strongly believe on the idea of being not a jack of all trades, but a jack of many trades, a master of some, right? And I try to apply that into my career, like moving from, let's say, mobile to infrastructure, to sales engineering, to consultancy. And like going back, you said ThoughtWorks, I think like have been a consultant myself. That's also been a great background to me. Like, I think like the idea that I had to work with clients in the past and have seen other very senior engineers acting in like more in a consultancy mode gave me skills, foundational skills, I would say, that prepare me to then be a good engineer and especially a good manager and director. And on the other side, on like being the glue person, right? I think like I always try to be the person that was filling the gaps, even if they are not part of my job description, right? Like I think Tony Riley has this amazing talk called Being Glue, right? That's about, it's all about, it's not about kind of like how you grow using that as a leverage, but it's more about how sometimes people like women or like diverse or like minorities in that get exploited because they end up doing all those blue works that don't get recognized as they're trying to be promoted or all those things, right? But I think like there is an upside of doing that because like you ship a lot of projects, you become essential, and you can navigate across the end-to-end. I think like having that like end-to-end ownership of all the projects, of everything, and be able to do the 80-20, like you're not expert by any means on everything that I did in my career, but I know the 80-20, right? I know like how to do many things. In some areas, I can go very deep, but not in all areas. So I think like those are the things that I would say that allowed me to grow in my career and are still kind of like teaching me lessons again and again.
I love that. Yeah, I think a lot of young developers, you and I maybe came up through different times. And if you're a young developer coming up now, you might feel the pressure to specialize super early. And yeah, I agree. I think you got to get a nice rounded perspective. It's the only, like if you're just doing mobile development and you never done any backend APIs, it's maybe hard to know what that team is facing, you know?
Yeah.
So you're kind of describing that like T-shape idea, right? Yeah. And I love that idea of like, maybe not jack of all trades, master of none, but maybe jack of many and, you know, maybe king or queen of a handful of them, you know, if you're going through for the card deck metaphor.
And David, I think the pressure to specialize was always there, at least in my career. I think I was always like, there was always more attractive to be the expert in one area because there's always like super bright and shiny things coming up. But I think you almost have to fight against that in some ways in a very assertive way, like try to fill the gaps, almost like if you see your career as like a skill block. So you see almost like a Tetris game and you're trying to fill the whole line, right? You get not super narrow or one thing. But anyways, I think that is like good, that is a good and bad of like specialization, but I always try to avoid that, even though like staying a year or 2 years on a project, you get plenty of specialization just by going deep on whatever the project.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I was just talking to a dad who lives nearby me, and he was talking about sports these days. Kids from a very early age specialize in one thing. If you want to play travel baseball, you got to do it all four seasons. And he's like, back in the day when people would do different sports every season, you learn different mental models, you develop different muscles physically, and that ultimately makes you better in the long run. And I think that metaphor kind of tracks to this. You need to kind of round yourself out a little bit to build those other muscles to be able to react when you get into some ambiguous moments or difficult challenges. And maybe that corresponds to that your ability to be that glue function as well, because you feel comfortable and confident flexing into a lot of different situations. Real quick, like to the point of you being a, you know, an engineer into engineering manager, what was the hardest thing for you to learn or adapt to switching more to the management side?
I would say it was definitely some aspects of people management. I think one thing, even though I was already doing a lot of what the engineering manager is supposed to do, even as a senior engineer, helping to break down projects, talking to stakeholders, all those things, right? There are definitely lessons there, how to navigate in organizations, like when to escalate, when to, like how do you avoid triangulation, all those things, right? But I think the hardest part was definitely to learn to give feedback effectively and to learn to delegate effectively. And I'm still learning those things, by the way. I think one mistake that a lot of managers make, and myself included, is either you are the manager that's shielding all the feedback from your people, right? Or you being the pass-through, right? You're the one that just passing whatever you receive without actually processing, without actually compiling the thing and actually asking yourself, do you agree with that? Do I see any evidence that person is that bad or is doing that? And I think I made many mistakes in the past, kind of like by being more a pass-through layer versus like actually digesting and compiling and delivering something to the engineers or report to me that were kind of like more actionable in some way, right? And it is a skill that's very hard to manage. And on the delegation side, I think it's like, it's very easy to get to the point where you just break down tasks and give tasks to people and don't let them actually be the task master, let's say, and taking the ownership of the full project, because people are going to ask, what should I do next? And it's very easy for you to get into that aspect of like, oh, my job as a manager is to break as many tasks as possible and to be the one that's gluing it all together, right? I think like those were very challenging skills to me. And I think as you scale, as you get more people on your org, you have bigger projects and more managers reporting to managers, all that, there are other challenges. But I think at the beginning, those were the two that I remember.
So now you're at Nubank, right? And you've had this long, lengthy career. Tell us a little bit about Nubank, just for people who are not familiar with it, because I know it's a Brazilian company. You're in New York, obviously, but you know it's a Brazilian company. Why don't you just do a quick catch up of how you got here and tell us a little bit about Nubank?
Yeah. So Nubank at this point is, I think, the largest fintech outside China by number of active customers. I think, like, so we are a financial service company. I mean, we cannot say we're a bank. And I think, like, the Nubank story is very interesting, especially to me, because I'm Brazilian and the bank started in Brazil, was that they went after and they were at the right time to try to, like, pretty much revolutionize how banking was done in Brazil, right? By, instead of, like, having branches and all those things, they went, what if we did something that's 100% mobile? What if we actually tried to, like, have a credit card that was, like no fee, right? In the US, it seems crazy to think that you don't have that option. But I think 10 years ago in Brazil and many, many places out there, that is a very hard, it's very hard to have access to credits, right? I think, like, Nubank was a pioneer, like, in Brazil with, like, doing so many things early on. And then, like, I think we are now not only in Brazil, but also in Colombia and Mexico and growing, like, there. And I think at this point, more than 50% of the adult population in Brazil is a Nubank customer. So we're very, very big there. And I think another, like, there are many things about Nubank, but I think the other thing that was remarkable was when the Brazilian Central Bank decided to launch Pix, that is kind of like a, it's kind of like Zelle and other things that we have in the US, but it was widely adopted and mandated by the government and, like, 100% of, like, no fees and, like, instantaneous transfer. Nubank was, like, the app that pioneered that, and, like, today is for big amount of the transactions that go over Pix in Brazil. And yeah, so I think we did the IPO, I believe it was end of 2021. And since then we have been growing a lot. We just crossed this year 100 million customers. That's
wow. Is amazing. 100 million customers. Yeah. Wow. And a mobile first company at that scale. And, you know, coming out of Brazil, it's just such an incredible story. And of course, the reason I know you and I know of Nubank is that Flutter was a big part of that story. And obviously Flutter is a big part of BGB's story. And Nubank was an extremely early adopter of it as well. So when you think about building something that big and, you know, making a choice that is so important, if mobile's core to the strategy, how did that decision get made, you know, and sort of how does a big, bold, innovative decision like that become a trusted, confident choice when you're betting your whole company on it?
So I mean, first thing that I have to say is that that was before my time, but I have a lot of context and I can give you all the details. But I think if I had to answer that, was like, the answer would be by doing POCs, by trying out the different technologies, by seeing what's possible to do with the alternatives that were available out there. But David, I think, like, the thing that's important to mention is that Nubank actually started as a native apps, right? And we actually had, like, even a Windows Phone app back in the day. So it started, and for, like, more than 5 years, all the way to 2018 or so, it was mostly native. And Nubank, one of the product areas at Nubank, had already started to play with some cross-platform frameworks, and I think with React Native, and had been super successful, but it was only one product out of the whole app. But the core, the foundation, was always native. And then 2019 came to a moment where the mobile engineering team at the time was feeling completely overloaded and not able to deliver everything that the business needed, right? Everything that was on the pipeline. And at the time, I think, like, mobile was being a bottleneck to innovation, bottleneck delivering features, and different areas, different engineering teams in the company were trying to innovate. And as you know, it's pretty hard to staff engineering team when, like, among many things, not only backend, like databases and all those things, because at Nubank we have, like, full end-to-end ownership. Every single product owns end-to-end the infrastructure, even though they leverage platforms. So I think, like, the idea of Flutter came when there was a moment that it was, the backlog was 6 months to 9 months of work. There was a central mobile engineering organization that had maybe 50, 60 people that were, like, overloaded with work. And we need to scale in some way. And then it started with like a few folks doing POCs on that. And then there is a very famous blog post that's way before my time where Nubank actually published the rationale and all the dimensions that Nubank considered to make the decision. I think like it was very, very tied between Flutter and React Native in many aspects, but then I think developer experience and the community and the fact that it was decoupled, all the dependency issues with React Native, all the build problems it had, and like and the fact that you could keep the native side and the Flutter side working together for a while you migrate things, while you get more confidence, was also a big decision factor. But it was not an easy decision. It was very traumatic in some ways. I would say that the transition, when you do that, like when you're transitioning platforms. And I think like you had a podcast interview a couple of months ago about the Betterment story. And I think there's a lot of similarities in there. It's like you get folks that are very passionate about iOS and Android, and the fact that you have additional layers, not you're going to be kind of like at least a couple of months behind, right? Whatever Apple and Google announced to catch up. And like, there's a lot of trade-offs, but I think I would say it was a decision made out of like frugality almost, right? Because it was very hard to maintain every single feature parity across two platforms. And then once you have that, you usually have like sometimes one platform is ahead of the other in terms of features, because you have like different people with different specifics, like specialization, and sometimes they're not all available at the same time. Sometimes you have crashes in platforms and all that. And I think Flutter filled the gap in so many ways because it made easier for folks that were not necessarily, didn't have a mobile background to understand things and to be able to contribute, right? And also it reduced the amount of code we had, because now like you no longer had like two different code bases and all the drawbacks you have with that. So I think like the context was there. Like it was the need to scale. It was like trying to find a platform we could leverage for the next like many years. And it was like something we could get started, but not necessarily migrate everything at once, right? And I think that was what happened at the time. And we had our challenge because it was early on for Flutter, right? It was like we created frameworks, we had a lot of like issues integrating between native and like all the Flutter sandwich problems, all the integrations with native SDKs and all that. But I think on the other side was a much better path where we could have, instead of like, I don't know, 50 to 60 engineers, to have hundreds of engineers working on the code base and delivering things independently. And I think like the modularization is also easier. The fact that we transitioned to a monorepo back even before we adopt Flutter actually helped with so many other aspects. So I think a lot better.
Yeah, it's interesting as we hear these stories and sort of the decisions and it gets so wrapped up usually in like a technology choice. People start comparing the programming language, the framework, you know, how maintained is it, you know, what's the frame rate performance and all that sort of stuff. And I think the nuance is, I've talked to more and more people about this, is kind of like those things don't actually matter that much to the decision. I mean, they do, but they're like table stakes, right? Like, of course, the app has to achieve your performance goals. It has to deliver a good experience to the end user. But what's been fascinating to me is that when people talk about these things, what they're really talking about, the human element, they're talking about developer experience. They're talking about portability of people to be able to work on things. They're talking about getting out from that huge backlog and the stress that comes from that. It's actually like solving all these organizational problems. And like the thing you said before about like, you can't keep up with the business kind of, right? Like the technology is becoming this bottleneck. So I feel like, you know, in a way where the App Store came out in what, like 2008, 2007? And, you know, we're in this like second or third era of it where I think people are like, all right, we no longer need to just have apps on these platforms. We need to do it in a way that we can move fast enough and keep up with the business. And so it's just really interesting to me that it's almost like more of a business and team sort of culture and human relationship choice than even like a, you know, programming language or some other technical choice. But you guys are also you're on the forefront of so many things, and being so early to a tool like this, like an ecosystem or a community. I think companies like Nubank are also at the forefront of sort of adopting some of these new technologies and solving sort of the leading edge of challenges. And one thing I know you've been talking a lot about recently is like the server-driven UI that you're adopting at Nubank these days. And I was wondering if you could, you know, dig into that a little bit, because I think server-driven UI is something, for whatever reason, actually in the last 3 months or so, I've been hearing about it everywhere. Like, it seems like everybody I talk to is like, oh yeah, we're going down server-driven UI. So maybe to start, like, can you just explain that concept for as you understand it and how you're using it at Nubank?
So I think like the idea of server-driven UI, I think is a very old idea. And it is like, I think I remember hearing about variations of server-driven UI, like even like 5 years ago, even more. Is the whole idea of what if the app could be driven by the backend, right? What if we had, I mean, it starts with like, what if we can have the whole content being like on the backend, and then, oh, what if I can actually drive different designs or different like variation of the same screen from the backend? But then like very quickly you get into the level of complexity that like, oh, this is not going to scale forever, right? Like is, and people make a lot of mistakes, a lot of similar mistakes when they try to go on the to the backend driven content in web apps, in mobile apps. So the idea of like server-driven UI is like is expansion on that. It's like, what if you could like not only have the content being dynamic, but what if the whole design system could be dynamic, right? And then you get like, oh, what if like instead of returning a JSON that I have to parse, and then I still have the whole like UI logic on the client, what if instead of sending that, what if we have like a whole dynamic design system, and I could also send functions, and I could also send the whole like UI structure from the server side. And the app is basically an interpreter almost, right? The app can compose itself because everything is coming from the backend, and the app has the only intelligence that you have on the app is the ability to get whatever the backend is sending and like and build a UI that follow your convention and be able to interact with the user. But then like there are many, many entry patterns. And I think at Nubank, we are on, I believe, the fourth generation of server-driven UI. I think we have tried a lot of things. Like initially, I mean, even I would say before we migrated to Flutter, there was an attempt to do like some server-driven UI with like forms. And I think like for flows that are more like wizards, you can easily do like a variation of server-driven UI where you can compose almost any kind of flow, and like you can adapt that for almost any kind of like basic form, right? And you can do that, and if you have a lot of those in the app, it can pay off very quickly. And you have the ability to quickly change things and do like, let's say, basic stuff in the app from the backend, especially if it is a not so sophisticated UI and not so like intense, like you don't have very intense needs of like interacting with native and all that is like very standard, right? And then the next variation after that is like, is to what if you actually have a full interpreter on the client that not only can, let's say, build screens, but can also have local functions, can also have like the whole logic to handle not only one screen, but a whole flow, right? What if you have like a thing that you're able to send not a particular screen, but the whole flow, like all driven from the backend, and do that? And what if then you could use the same language that you use on your backend service to write the language? What if they could live on the same repository that you have your BFF or like even your APIs, right? And you get to a lot of like different challenges, and is more, oh, now I need to have a way to send functions that are executed on the client, but I'm sending code that's pretty much that can be compiled or interpreted like in Dart or whatever language. I'm not like, because it's unpractical for a lot of things. Every single time you have a click, you have to send like a network request to then do something, right? you need to build a lot of things to be able to support that. Now you need stack trays. Now you have almost a full-blown interpreter there. Now you need to send, but then you get to another trade-off that is now you have very big payloads. Every time you open a flow, you have a huge payload instead of 30 kbytes, 100 kbytes of JSON. I mean, even if you gzip and all that, now you have 500 kbytes because you're not only sending the content, you're also sending the structure over the network, right? And now you have also additional layer of processing because you cannot render all the optimizations that you have at build time. Now you don't have because you might have different permutations of components that need to be loaded and they are not, let's say, in memory already. So you get to a lot of those things. But at Nubank, so we have played a lot with Cerebrum UI, and we have a very successful case of Cerebrum UI, but it was not something we built overnight. It was not something we built over the last 3 months. It was something that took years and many attempts, and something that we were able to leverage, the way that Flutter works, the way the material works, that's kind of almost baked in on the SDK, right? And build a design system on top of that and be able to be decoupled from what's on the client so that we can send everything over the network. And there are many, many variations of that. We created DSL so you can code enclosure on the back end. And then we have some interpretation via, what is that? The protobuf that gets on the wire. And then so we have a very strong contract between the backend and the client. So, and I think at the high level, I think that's Cerebrum UI is the ability of not having any dependency on the release train or on your new build getting to the app. But then there is different also styles of Cerebrum UI, right? I think that is the style that you check for the new version. There is a new version available at the startup, and then you pull almost the binary, and you have that kind of mechanism that the user is always one version behind. So every time they open the app, we load the new version in the background. The next time they launch, you get the latest. But there is the server-driven where you actually, you don't do that. You don't, you have a binary that's static, but it has an interpreter. And every time you call the server side, you get the entire thing that will work on that version. And you're not checking once, oh, do I have any updates? So there are different variations of
it. So correct me if I'm wrong, the business case for why you'd want to do this is to get around the build train and the releases you have to put out to the app stores, essentially. Is that what drives somebody to go down the server-driven UI path?
The initial reason might be that you want to do continuous delivery. I would say the biggest reason, in my opinion, is that it's almost impossible to do bug fixes it's impossible for you to ship a new binary every time you have a new PR merge, right? Forget, user is not going to be downloading a new binary every day, multiple times a day. Then there are some business needs that's if every time you need to do a bug fix, you need to wait all the users to catch up on the new version. And every time you need to launch a new feature, you need to make sure that the user base is lagging on a version, right? So it's very challenging to coordinate launching of things because then you don't have the code on that version. So users are not going to be able to see at the same time. The other thing is, so I think I mentioned, the limitation of release training, shipping the binary multiple times a day, and the hard thing about bug fix. And the other thing is even though Flutter is very good technology and very easy for engineers to learn, it's still not super high leverage or how can I say? It's there is still things you can do, especially if you are on a big company and you want to make as easy as possible and create platforms that abstract away the nuances and having all, imagine that you have, as we have at Nubank, we have a 2,000 engineers org, right? Like we have 2,000 engineers that not all those 2,000 engineers are working in product-facing squads, but like a good chunk of them. So it's like, imagine that every single one of those squads now, like they own like the product end-to-end. And if you have, every time you need to build a new screen or build a new flow, you need to go and do the Flutter screens, and then you need to do the server side, and you need to know like database and all those things, like Kafka, like event-driven, like all those things is very hard. But if, like, it's not very hard, but it's not very optimal, right? And then imagine if those engineers have like higher and higher level platforms that they can leverage that abstract away many of the nuances, and they can do, like, for example, like do the mobile flows along with the service layer. And imagine if the same way that we deploy like microservice multiple times a day, you can also deploy the screens, the flows. Like, and imagine that now you don't have a new API you have to maintain, because if every time you have to do a new flow, you need to call an API, like do a post, do a transaction, whatever. What if we could like have a framework that's able to handle that, and we push that, like all those integrations, all those things to the backend? Now is like, instead of having, I don't know, like 5 engineers, you can have like 2 engineers doing the whole thing. So I think it was more, there is a business demand. And then if you get into things like experimentation, it's like very hard to do experimentation mobile if you are operating under the constraints of shipping once a week a new binary, and every time you need to do like, oh, we want to do a new variation of this screen. But if everything is server driven and you can play along with that and you can bug fix those things, it's like the case of server driven UI at Nubank was like, was a platform that was born to solve one project need that had like something, like it was very bullish on this, that had some needs that were very particular. And then like the moment that the different product areas start to hear about that, they start to adopt organically. Oh, we want to use this platform. We want to contribute. We want to make it better. We want to put engineers to, because they saw that as the next, like the next lever. If like native was here, Flutter was here, I mean, server driven UI was here. And like that, I cannot say how revolutionary this was for us.
Just moving up the abstraction stack, and the same. So if I'm hearing you correctly, the same sort of motivation behind going something like Flutter, where you used to be maintaining 2 apps, now you're maintaining 1. It makes it easier for those developers. Now you even squished it even more. And I think that maybe gets back to your point about being a developer that isn't so focused on one thing, because that would maybe be a difficult way to develop if you were like hardcore only, you know, iOS developer. That's all you do. I only write Swift. And now it's sort of changing the notion of what you're doing to being like, I'm not a mobile developer or backend developer. I'm a product developer. You know, that's it. Like what we're doing is we're working on making the product ship. It's very interesting. Has it changed the way that like designers and backend engineers and front end engineers all work together? Because I would imagine the role of then the Flutter app is essentially to maintain that interpreter. It's almost like you built your own little like browser essentially, right? With its own like rendering rules and things that you put together. I would imagine, how does that flow from like design into backend development, front end development? And because it's the lines are blurred now a bit.
Yeah. It is a great question. And I would say, and we still have a lot of native and like mobile complexity. And so we still have platform teams. I think like there maybe 2 things that are very important to mention. Like Nubank has like 6 engineering principles that are very strong in our culture, but there's 2 that I think are very relevant to this. Things like, one is called canonical platforms widely applied. So it's like, we try to have canonical platforms that are applied widely across the stack. And that like started with like, for example, things like Clojure, Kafka, Kubernetes, right? Those are high-level platforms that we try to apply across the stack to everything. Like there is no exception of, oh, you're going to build a microservice in like, I don't know, in Python, or it was always like, no, the canonical platform is Clojure. We like, there might be some very particular cases to build some in another language, but if you do that, you're going to lose all the canonicity, right? All the the tooling we have to like all the common libraries, all the things, right? So I think like this is very strong. There's another engineering principle that is called like product ownership or end-to-end product ownership. That's like more than being, let's say, an engineer, like you are a problem solver, but more than this is you're not a mobile engineer. You are like an engineer. So it's like you don't like you solve problems, you don't like force solutions, right? Like what is the problem we're trying to solve? And you go after the problem, you don't go after, like, you don't get passion, like passion about different solutions, right? So I think like, and then like, this is very important because the only way to achieve that, like the only way to have canonical platforms and to have like end-to-end product ownership is if you have high, super high level and highly effective platforms that are enabling those folks to, like they're hiding the complexity and the chaos as much as possible to those folks that are maintaining the product side. And like, so it's not that we don't have front-end engineers or mobile engineers, is that almost everybody is a mobile engineer, right? Like we don't have infrastructure engineers or backend engineers that like with all the platforms and the platform teams we have supporting that. And all the documentation, and because we're doing everything in one way, is super easy for folks to transition and navigate across and to find examples and to kind of like and to replicate patterns or to learn, right? Because it is high level and is widely applied, right? So, but it means that we push a lot of complexity to the bottom of the stack. Because in order to maintain like a server-driven UI framework, it's hiding all the complexity, like to have a good performance is a huge challenge because now we have to deal with all the maybe inefficiencies that we have along the way to create that efficient velocity, right? Now you have a lot bigger payloads. Now you have like an interpreter on the, you know, now you have like things that if you're building native, you get optimization out of the box. Now you have like platform chains that are their full job is to find needs and to kind of like pushing the level of abstraction even higher. And also we need to provide documentation, we need to provide things so engineers can quickly onboard those platforms and they can quickly put something together that's gonna solve their needs. And even like if they have some very particular need and the platform chain is busy with other things, they can go in and do inner sourcing, they can go in and contribute to the platform. And I think that was what happened with our like internal case of like server-driven UI, because like everybody was like, this is revolutionary. Like now I, even though I cannot do what I want now, I go and contribute to the platform and then I do my feature later because then I know next time I need, I have something that is going to speed up things even more.
You said a word there that I think is interesting, like revolutionary, right? Like the people looked at them, they're like, oh, this is revolutionary, so let's give it a try. Somehow you guys have established this culture and an acceptance and sort of a momentum around doing these bold, innovative solutions that are hard and that, you know, some teams may not bite off because it might be, well, what if we go down the server? Like you said, it took years and there are probably some teams that like tried it, did it a little bit. It was like, oh, this is going to be really, really hard. And they probably backed off, but you did it with Flutter. You tried it. You got into it. You eventually did more and more and more of it. You got server driven UI in there. You've been working on that. What is it about Nubank you think that has made that team more amenable, like more able to embrace these sort of bolder, more innovative technology choices?
I would say the culture is a big thing, but I would say it's also the founders in some way that live and breathe at those values is like the early joiners in the company that are very bullish on this approach. It was the fact that we established those foundational components, those foundational principles early on, and we were very good at enforcing it company-wide, right? And I think Ed is one of the co-founders and was the CTO for many years, and he was on the ground with people. He was like, even when he was CTO, he was very influential on like everything we did. And like in being super bullish on this idea of like canonical platforms, of platform cheese, of like product ownership of like full product ownership, right? And not letting the whatever every time that a new engineer comes from a different company to corrupt the vision, to corrupt the guidelines, and being super, I think like strict is the wrong word, but like is like the fact that we give time to everybody to learn, and like, but we try to keep the canonical approach canonical. And by doing this, we have found ways to do things that would be so much easier to say, oh, this library that's not available in Clojure, or I need to do something that's out of the box. Let me spin a new microservice, or let me break out of the canonical way. And so I think like it was a combination of all those things, and also the kind of engineers that join Nubank. They're very passionate about the mission of the company, right? It's fight complexity that is to like to serve like customers that have been unserved, right? Like to give access to credit, to kind of like to make their life easier. And I think like it's to challenge the status quo in so many ways, and also in engineering, right? Like, and we need to be frugal. Like we need to, with the scalability issues we had, like we had to make those choices. Otherwise, it could go sideways very quickly.
So commitment to that path, I like that word canonical choice. You know, you make these canonical choices, and it sounds like the founders respected those and pushed and made people adhere to those as the company grew. Because I could definitely see the company grows, you get new leadership, people change over. And, you know, Sam in the talk with Sam from Betterment, he talked about these like lava layers that come over, and like a new lava layer comes over, and you just get these layers that are constantly eating the thing before it. And before you know it, there's just all these little changes over time that make it unmaintainable. Sounds like the founders there developed a culture that helped people to stick to their guns while embracing innovative choices, right, along the way. Because certainly you've made a whole bunch of those. And to that end, I was wondering, like, given all the interesting, innovative choices and challenges that you guys have overcome and doing, like, as you look ahead with technology, what are some things that excite you, or even maybe frighten you a little bit when you look ahead and changes? Like, what are the challenges or opportunities that you think are coming for engineering teams?
Perfect. I will answer that, but I have to go back to add two more things that I was just thinking about. Like, what made the Nubank's culture so successful? I think, like, being a bottom-up culture and having full ownership and autonomy to do things quickly without actually like being super top-down, where like all the values that were always there, they're still there. And those are so crucial. Like the fact that Nubank was pushing to have like on the same squad, not only engineering and product, but also customer service, also like everything that was in marketing, truly, truly like multidisciplinary teams that they could propose the roadmap, they could propose the OKR, they could propose the path to get that product to market, it allow the company to scale very, very rapidly and with like many things at the same time. So I think like the level of autonomy and trust and in the leverage on top of the platforms were like also another big thing. And another thing, David, and sorry for this, I think like for server-driven UI, there is another thing that is huge is governance. Because like when you have everyone working on, even on a monorepo, on a big native app, you have to all be like passing the same build and compiling on the same binary, right? But the moment that you're able to like do server-driven UI, almost the idea of micro frontends, right, where you have the coupled chains moving different repositories and deploying different places, and this architecture of server-driven UI is able to keep it up even with folks deploying at different speed. And if one thing fails, you don't fail the whole app, you don't compromise the whole app, right? And you are able to create something that's robust enough to handle all those permutations, and you have like a revolutionary, like almost modularity that is very hard to get in mobile. Like you're basically pushing mobile to be a distributed system instead of being like a client side thing.
It's a lot. There's a lot going on there. Yeah. No, I appreciate that insight. Thanks for jumping back to us. And yeah, just to wrap us up, you know, as we get into this, go back to that question before around sort of opportunities and challenges ahead, and maybe some insights you have from your experience from Nubank. Just wrap it, like pulling it all back together, you know, what would you recommend to other people to be successful with technology?
So I would go back to the two things that I said at the beginning that I think are the things that my opinion may you like, and I think this applies to companies and to also to individuals, but it's like this idea of like being the glue and this idea of like being a specializing generalist or generalizing specialist. And of course you need to like surf different waves, and now we are on AI, now there are like new technologies coming up, there are challenges here and there, right? And I'm not saying that you shouldn't go and invest in a new technology. I'm not saying that you should do everything that is not on your job title and your job description. Like, I think there is a limit to that. But like having the idea of like full end-to-end ownership and be able to navigate across the stack, going on the all the layers of abstractions that are sitting below that technology you're using, I think those things are going to be valuable again and again and again. And like now with JNI, with like whatever is coming up, right? Like quantum computing, like if you don't actually go underneath the concepts, and you're not going to be able to innovate in an effective way. One reason why Nubank was able to innovate in a very effective way, especially on the server-driven UI, was that you had folks with different, but they had seen different things in different parts of the stack. And you're able to put a solution that leveraged all those ideas and also had some elements of mobile, right? If you had someone that was only doing mobile development and they had now to do a whole distributed system architecture, you're not going to be able to do it because they don't understand what's going on, what's possible, what other areas have seen and failed, right? So I think that is the same thing. And I think with technology, that is the law of leaky abstraction, right? That I think is this famous blog post from Joan Softer on that. And I think like you need to be careful when you're operating at too much high level and you don't know what's going on underneath, right? And that applies, especially if you work on a company that has like frameworks on top of frameworks and you're working on something custom in-house that does a bunch of things, but you don't know how to debug, you don't know how to go layer by layer. You don't understand concepts that are kind of like neighbor to your area, but they are like different languages stop there. So I think like those are the things that I think made Nubank successful, because a lot of those engineers, they didn't have like, oh, I'm like, I don't know, I'm a Flutter engineer. I only work with Flutter. It's like, no, Flutter is a tool and I leverage it as much as possible. But if it's not helping me to solve the problems of my customers, of the business, I'm gonna drop it and I'm not gonna regret it. And I'm not gonna attach my identity to a technology. And it's easy to get into that thing where you see almost a technology or a new innovation as your new kind of like your new identity. I would say like those things, if you keep those principles in mind and you push yourself to try to take end-to-end ownership, navigate all the layers and being the glue there, I think you can be very successful, like anywhere in technology.
That's super well said. Very, very important concepts. And increasingly more and more, I think as I see more companies talk to more people and see challenges and successes that people face, it really does boil down to, I think, the people you got and the culture you've established. And so many people blame the technology for low performing, products or something like that. And a lot of times it's not really the technology that's the problem. It's the team dynamics, the cultural setups, the organizational design, and all the other things that kind of come along with it. And like you said, I think that's a really insightful thing. I think right now people probably are scared of AI. A lot of people, are they going to take developer jobs? And to me, I just see it as an extent. It's like just something else like Flutter. It's just going to make developers more productive. And like you said, if you are the glue type person who is that sort of generalist, specialist, who can adapt to these things and be productive in a lot of different ways, that's going to make you and your team successful and adaptive. And it sounds like that's what's helped Nubank along the way. So I just want to thank you for coming here and sharing your journey and your stories with me and with everyone who will listen to the podcast. What we'll do is we'll get some links from you and we'll put them in the bottom of the podcast. So if anybody's interested in learning more, if you guys are hiring, or I know you've got some articles on your server-side driven UI approach and maybe some talks and other things. So we'll put those. But I just wanted to thank you for taking time out of your busy day. I know you got a lot on your schedule, and these days everyone's working super hard, especially right now. So thank you so much for coming on, and we'll let you know how things go. So,
thank you, David. Appreciate it.
All right.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you for the invite.
Thank you for joining us on Build to Succeed, a Very Good Ventures podcast. We hope you enjoy exploring the experiences and insights of leaders that have built successful digital products. Please take a moment to leave us a review, and don't forget to subscribe to get our latest episodes. Thanks again, and see you next time.